who's in town running a workshop. I notice for the first time how heavily creased the lines around her lips are, as if strained from dispensing so much wisdom. I struggle to take it in. The hardest truth to swallow is one that follows a full meal that one thought was truth, but turned out to be the opposite. "Can't you see?" Rick turns to address me directly. "All your relationships were doomed to fail. It didn't matter what kind you tried, whether it was with one person or 100. His eyes blaze with the fire of conviction he gets when channeling the gods of harsh truth. "Because it's not relationships that are broken. It's you." And that's when it sinks in. The battle is lost. I feel a wrecking ball swing through my head, smashing all the open relationships, the swinger orgies, the free love communes, and the threesome adventures. If Rick had told me this any earlier, I wouldn't have been able to hear him. I would have argued, resisted, and tried to prove him wrong. But for the first time, I have no what-if arguments and scenarios left to debate him with. All that remains is me, sitting with my family of choice, my heart in pieces over losing Ingrid, and my mind flagellating itself for every bad decision since leaving rehab. As for Sage, I returned from Machu Picchu ready to break things off. And she was already gone. She sent a long email explaining apologetically that she felt she was losing her identity in our relationship and needed to find herself. So she decided to move back to Brooklyn with her ex-girlfriend Winter, who she's now apparently dating again. Even though I was about to do almost the exact same thing to Sage, it came so unexpectedly and on the heels of losing Ingrid that I was emotionally wrecked. I suppose when a bandage covering an open wound is peeled off, it's going to bleed a little. "So what should I do?" I ask Rick and Lorraine. All evening, they've been destroying what remains of my ego, exposing my every thought as a fraud and my every emotion as infantile. Almost 2 years have passed since I went to rehab. I tried sex addiction recovery, and it didn't work for me. I tried monogamy, and it didn't work for me. I tried non-monogamy, and it didn't work for me. So what's left? "You need to try the only thing you haven't experienced yet," Lorraine suggests. "What's that?" "Anhedonia." I repeat the word clumsily. I've read many big books with big words, but I've never come across anhedonia before. Whatever it is, I don't like the sound of it. "It's the dark place of not feeling," she elaborates. "People feel dead in the place of anhedonia. They can't experience joy." I think back to Henry's ninth emotion. That's what it's called. Not the death emotion, but anhedonia. "Why would I want to experience that?" "Because," Lorraine replies, "in order to return to homeostasis and have any clarity on who you are and what you need, you have to detox from the intensity of these one-up, one-down relationships. You've been through a constant cycle of intensity, from your relationship with your mother all the way up to your relationship with Sage." She pauses to order a glass of wine, and for some reason I'm surprised, as if drinking is taboo for addiction therapists. "You'll find that being committed to your authentic life supersedes the intensity." I sit in silence, processing this. In my heart, I know she's right. I spent all year thinking that if somehow I found the right relationship, my problems would magically disappear. But the one relationship I didn't try was the one with myself. For a love avoidant, I've done a good job of constantly having some sort of girlfriend for the last 8 years. Maybe that's because there's no better place to hide from intimacy than in a relationship. When I last sat with Rick and Lorraine, it felt like every door in the world was opening to me. Now they're all shut, locked, and sealed with concrete, including, most painfully of all, the only one I want to walk through, the one leading back to where I started. "But what should I do about Ingrid's wedding?" I ask. "Don't worry about Ingrid for now," Lorraine says as the wine arrives, her words searing my addled heart. Just let yourself be emptied out and deal with whatever comes up in the process. I'll help you. Then we can fill you up with the things you need, and you can see how you really feel about Ingrid then. People do lemon juice and cayenne pepper diets to clean out their insides, so why not a cleanse for the psyche? Then I can start consuming healthy thoughts and experiences. That is, as long as Lorraine isn't going to fill me with the sexual shame Joan was peddling. I know I can't heal myself alone. I barely even trust myself anymore. But I can't help feeling that rehab was as harmful as it was helpful. What kind of things do you want to fill me up with? I ask to be certain. With freedom, she replies. That's the last word I expected to hear her say. What do you mean? Lorraine places her glass on the table, takes my hand in hers, and looks into my eyes. She then replies slowly, making sure each word lands meaningfully. In life, we are born innocent and pure, beautiful and honest, and in a state of oneness with each moment. As we develop, however, our caregivers and others load us with baggage. Some of us keep accumulating more and more baggage until we become burdened by all the weight, trapped in beliefs and behaviors that keep us stuck. But the true purpose of life is to divest yourself of that baggage and become light and pure again. You've been searching for freedom this whole time. That is true freedom. I thought I'd at least healed something during rehab and my year of sex addiction therapy, but clearly all I did was identify my issues and then go consciously live an unconscious life. It takes more than advice, books, meetings, therapy, and rehab to change. It takes more than even a powerful, unwavering, full-bodied desire to do so. It takes humility. And there is nothing more humbling than the past year and the realization that I've made a mess of everything and may never experience true happiness, love, and family if I keep trying to do things my way. The underlying cause of most unfulfilled lives is that we are simply too close to ourselves to see clearly enough to get out of our own way. Why don't you come back to the hospital and continue working on yourself? Lorraine offers. My enthusiasm instantly fades as I imagine going back to rehab with Joan. I'd rather move back in with Belle, Anne, and Veronica. Lorraine reads my mind, but privately, just with me. Really? You'd do that? It may be your last chance. She tilts her wine glass to her wise lips and lets the last drops fall into her throat. I'll be working with your friend Adam in a few weeks. If you'd like to, you can join us. But be vigilant. You're at great risk right now of jumping into another relationship. And if you can't refrain from relationships and sexual contact throughout this entire process, then I'm going to recommend you check back into rehab. A triumphant smile flashes across Rick's face, and the adapted adolescent in me, the grounded teenager who's been running my life so poorly this last year, makes a last desperate attempt to save himself. So basically, he asks, you want me to castrate myself? Yes, Rick replies coolly, we do. Chapter 2. In the weeks that follow, as I wind down my life and wait to get help from Lorraine, masturbation saves me. You want to ask out someone you recently met? Masturbate first, then see if you still want to spend 6 hours whining, dining, and entertaining her, desperate for an outcome that's not only going to disappoint you if it doesn't occur, but may even disappoint you if it does. You want to call an escort? Masturbate first, then see if you really want some junkie who looks nothing like her decade-old photoshopped images to give you a lazy handjob. You want to call a former fuck buddy? Masturbate first, then see if you still want to invite her over, have sex that isn't as good as you remembered, then spend the rest of the night figuring out how to politely get rid of her without hurting her feelings. Masturbate when you want to break the rules of your relationship or your celibacy agreement, and you'll soon discover that once your desires are fulfilled in your imagination, the need to live them out in real life suddenly doesn't seem so urgent. Once the brain's reward center has gotten its hit of dopamine, it doesn't need another one, at least not for a little while. They say that viewing porn correlates with depression. I'm not sure whether it's a cause or a symptom, but now I understand why it's so appealing. It's not just a world where sex is easy, but also where sex doesn't involve dealing with someone's emotions before, during, and after the experience. She doesn't yell at you if you aren't faithful and you start watching another porn clip. She doesn't shame you for your taste in women, your fetishes, your performance, or your body, income, and faults, unless being shamed happens to turn you on, in which case she's glad to do it all night. And she doesn't mind if you come before it's done, then roll over and go to sleep and never talk to her again. It's just instant sexual gratification with no waiting, no rejection, no emotion, no commitment, no obligation whatsoever, plus infinite variety. The strict sexaholics and sex addiction therapists definitely wouldn't agree with the jerk-off solution, and it's delaying my entry into the pleasureless world of anhedonia, but it serves its purpose as a band-aid, keeping me faithful to myself and my promise to Lorraine before seeing her again. The only problem is that after the orgasm, I'm still stuck with myself and my mistakes. I think about Ingrid's footsteps clomping outside the front door, her mocking shouts of freedom, the glee she took in blocking my path when I tried to enter a room, and the warmth of her body, heart, and spirit. All she tried to do was bring joy and laughter into my life, and in return, I gave her the best of what I had to offer. Resentment. One lonely evening, after my porn pity party, I bring a stack of unopened mail and random bills to the bed. That's when I come across Ingrid's wedding invitation again. Perhaps it's time to come to terms with her marriage and move on to the last stage of grief. Acceptance. I turn the envelope nervously in my hands for a few moments, wondering if she's marrying the James Dean on steroids guy. Then I slide an index finger along the flap, my heart thudding loudly, my body bracing for the shock. I scan the card and see the words, Hans de la O. She's marrying her brother? No, idiot. Her brother is getting married. And for some reason, maybe accidental, maybe spiteful, you've been invited. My heart bursts open and hope rushes through me, chasing away the darkness. When Ingrid and I were dating, her shy brother told me that he'd never had a girlfriend. Something must have changed. And now I've been granted one last opportunity to see Ingrid again. This just may be the best day of my life. There's only one problem. Though I've displayed a modicum of self-control by avoiding sex and relationships these last few weeks, I'm still exactly the same. If I truly want to change, not only do I need to cut the porn out, it's certainly not doing anything positive for my mind, but I need Lorraine's help more than all the sex and alternative relationships in the world. The next morning, Lorraine calls unexpectedly. There's something I want you to do for me, she says. Anything, I respond. And I mean it. Chapter 3. Dr. Hasi Wallam doesn't look like the kind of scientist who churns out 80-page research papers that are barely decipherable to anyone without a PhD in biology. He has long, stringy Kurt Cobain hair, a boyish face sculpted like Ryan Gosling's, and the relaxed poise of a young Marlon Brando. Over dinner, I ply him with cocktails until finally I ask what I'm there to find out. When she called, Lorraine suggested that since I liked talking to experts so much, I should see Wallum. He's a famous geneticist, she explained, and I want you to ask him a question. Not surprisingly, considering her perceptiveness, it was a question that's been playing on a loop in my head for the last 2 years. One which, even now, as I'm praying for a miracle when I see Ingrid again at her brother's wedding, has been lurking in the shadows of my mind. Is being monogamous something that's genetically determined, or do I have a choice in the matter? When I asked for Wallum's contact information, Lorraine replied, "Oh, I don't know him. I've just read about him." As I researched Wallum, I wondered what Lorraine was up to. Everything he stands for seems to contradict what she's been telling me. His experiments, along with similar research conducted by his colleagues at Emory University, have led to the discovery of the exact biological factor responsible for monogamy. Evidently, if you have long receptors in the brain's reward center for the hormone vasopressin, then you're more likely to be monogamous. If not, then you're a born player. One science writer, summarizing these findings, concluded, "Devoted fathers and faithful partners are born, not made or shaped by a father's example." If this is true, then there's no point in seeing Lorraine again or even going to Hans's wedding. I'm as non-monogamous as I am male, and stuck with my own species, whether I like it or not. I wonder if this is a ruse of Lorraine's to test my sincerity and see if I'm willing to change on the basis of faith alone, in defiance of proof, evolution, genetics, and experience. After a few drinks with Wallum, I pop Lorraine's question. Do you think monogamy is genetically determined? The answer seems obvious, considering what I know already about Wallum, but his response surprises me. Not entirely, he says, and I find I'm relieved to hear those two words. There have been studies where scientists have taken young rodents away from their parents, and as a result, they get a much lower amount of the receptors. How about with people? They've done similar research with humans, looking not exactly at receptors in the brain, because that's really difficult to do in people, but at plasma levels of oxytocin and vasopressin. And kids in orphanages have lower levels. So generally, good parenting will promote better oxytocin and vasopressin systems in the long run, and these are linked with more closely bonding individuals when it comes to romantic relationships. We haven't published it yet, but that's exactly what we're looking at right now. It makes sense. If you have a healthy bond with your parents, you'll have a healthy pair bond with others as an adult, which, considering my upbringing, doesn't bode well. So let me ask you, I go on, if you're an adult and you don't have a gene coding for long vasopressin receptors, and you've been badly parented, is there any hope? I think so, he says, and a second wave of relief rises above the first. A messed up childhood makes it hard, and it gets even more complicated as you get older, but it's not set in stone. We haven't found anything that's completely genetic, not even those really hurtful diseases like autism and schizophrenia, or things like intelligence. There's still some sort of environmental factor involved, so you get to change things. It seems I am in control of my romantic destiny after all. Now I see why Lorraine wanted me to speak to Wallum, to crush my last reservoir of resistance and skepticism. The argument that monogamy and fidelity are evolutionarily unnatural, or culturally anachronistic, or just not lifestyles I was built for. She probably doesn't want to hear me intellectually debating these points all through therapy again. Wallum orders another drink, then runs a hand through the thick hair that genetics has blessed him with. "Can I ask why you're raising these specific questions?" he inquires. I tell him about the last few years of cheating, rehab, failed monogamy, failed non-monogamy, regret, and repentance. That's the sad thing for women, he says afterward, shaking his head. You can't be perfect enough for a man not to want to cheat. It's a surprisingly cynical comment, one that seems to come more from experience than from research. So I ask him, what's your relationship situation? He heaves a sigh and confesses, I think I experience relationships as more difficult than other people do. He slumps back in the booth and I lean in, sensing that he may be going through a crisis similar to mine. So, I ask, if you could design the perfect relationship for yourself, considering the genetic, evolutionary, and behavioral factors we've been talking about, what would it be? I can't really answer that at the moment. You must have a secret plan. Everyone has one. I used to have a few until I experienced them in real life. Wallum thinks for a while, then gives his answer. Being a loner. That's a solution. He forces a smile. Considering that you're a biologist, I reply, that wouldn't be a good evolutionary strategy. Yeah, he admits. So that's no good. Then he sighs and says, I don't really know. Actually, that's my answer. Maybe that's one of the reasons I'm studying these things, to understand why I feel the way I do myself. Suddenly, Wallum's no longer a vaunted scientific researcher, but a guy just like me, trying to figure out why something as simple as loving someone is so complicated in real life. So is it hard for you to be faithful? I press. Not exactly. I would never be unfaithful. But in relationships, I feel limited because I'm missing out on other things. It's a bit tragic. You can be with someone that you really, really like and still feel a bit sad that you can't have anything else. So you get depressed because you feel trapped, more or less. Can I ask you a personal question? Did you ever have to take care of your mother growing up? Not when I was really, really young, but later on, definitely. Emotionally or physically, I ask. Primarily emotionally. Interesting. And so I end this last week exactly where Lorraine wants me. I recognize that I can make every argument in my head against monogamy, and they may even be right. It probably isn't natural. But none of this is going to make me happy or bring me closer to Ingrid, or if she won't have me, to any meaningful connection. The person who is too smart to love is truly an idiot. With my last pillar of intellectual resistance demolished, I fly to Lorraine to be healed, to become worthy of Ingrid, to become worthy of myself, to find out who I am beyond the perpetually turning wheels of desire, manipulation, and intellectualization that have run my entire life. Chapter 4. It's time for you to get your life back, Lorraine announces, rising in front of us in a green and brown dress like Mother Earth herself. Your childhood is a terrorist, and it's holding you hostage. Adam and I sit in plastic chairs arranged side by side in an administrative building off the site of the rehab hospital. Calvin, who I invited with Lorraine's permission, is also with us. Except this time, we're not here as sex addicts, and there are no red tags hanging from our necks. Lorraine has decided to try a new type of workshop, one that's not designed specifically for people with addictions, but for all men and women who, like us, spend their lives running in circles like dogs chained to a stake in the ground. And that stake is trauma. All of you share something in common, Lorraine continues. Each of you had a mother who was unhappy and who you could not help. And that has been the starting point for your three very different journeys away from intimacy and connection. As she speaks, all our confusions and complications suddenly seem so clear and simple. Our lives are like children's building block games, in which objects are stacked one by one on top of each other. You can build the tower to a certain height without a problem, but as it continues to grow, eventually the instability of the foundation will cause everything to come tumbling down. But, I wonder, how do you fix the base when you've stacked so much on top of it already? As Wallum put it, the older you get, the more complicated it becomes. The goal this week, Lorraine concludes, is to get the three of you unstuck. She starts with Adam, pulling out his genogram and trauma worksheet, which he brought for her to re-examine. "Are you happy in your marriage?" she asks him. "No, I'm really not. What I had with this other woman showed me the happiness I was missing." "Is your wife happy in the marriage?" I don't think so." Adam purses his lips and shakes his head. This is the conversation I've been having with him over and over. If anyone can get through to Adam, it's Lorraine. Have you ever, even before your affair, been happy and content with your wife? "Not really. I was way too young to get married. I think one of the reasons I got so involved with the soccer leagues was just to do something away from her." "So don't you think," and here Lorraine holds Adam's genogram in front of him, "that it's time for someone in your family to make a stand and take care of their own needs for once? Look at your parents. Your mom is unhappy and medicating with romance novels and pills, while your dad walls off and keeps busy. This is a behavior that's been passed down for generations, and it only takes one courageous person to stop the cycle of silent suffering and sacrifice." "But how?" Adam seems genuinely stumped. "By being true to yourself. People always ask how supposedly good German people could have been complicit in the atrocities of the Nazi regime. And one part of the answer is the family system. Children in that time were taught to be obedient to their fathers, that father is always right, and that they must make sacrifices for the parents to whom they owe their entire existence." She pauses to make sure we get it. "And then what happens? The government demands loyalty, obedience, and sacrifice until you have a nation of people violating their internal value system for the fatherland." We sit in silence and take in her words, their apparent truth, and the profound way in which trauma shapes history. "I'm passionate about what I'm doing," she continues, "because I believe that functional parenting is the secret to world peace. And the only way to make functional parents is to heal psychological wounds with the same urgency that we heal physical wounds. Do you get what I'm saying?" She looks almost beatific as she speaks. "I get it," Adam responds enthusiastically. "So then tell me, are you willing to stay in your marriage even at the cost of sacrificing yourself and hurting your children?" He closes his eyes and exhales slowly through his nose. Then he bites his lower lip and shakes his head. "I agree with what you're saying 100%, but I can't leave. I just can't. Not while the kids are still in the house." Lorraine's gaze bores into Adam's being. "Then I want you to repeat after me. I will stay in this relationship, even at the cost of sacrificing myself and all my needs and hurting my children." Backed into a corner, Adam blanches. Tears well up in my eyes as I watch him grapple with the truth. "This is exactly what my parents have done, to themselves, to my brother, to me." Finally, Adam crosses his arms over his chest, opens his mouth, and, to everyone in the room's surprise, repeats Lorraine's every word. Calvin and I stare at him slack-jawed. "And this is the moment when I finally understand why I had such a hard time committing to Ingrid after rehab. Even when we see the truth, trauma still prevents us from reaching it, like a rock slide blocking the road to our future." Lorraine turns to us and says, not with the anger we were expecting, but with acceptance and empathy for Adam. Do you see how strong this is? How trauma can destroy individuals and nations and generations. More than our relationships are at stake here, I think. The future is at stake. As Lorraine swings the door open to dismiss us for lunch, we see a sight that makes our hearts freeze. Joan. Chapter 5. Joan looks intently at each of us, singeing us with the coals of her eyes, then says, unsmiling, "Welcome back, gentlemen." Turning to Lorraine, she tells her, sweetly, "See me in my office tomorrow morning." It is the quickest group castration in history. Even Lorraine seems rattled. A brief shudder runs through her head and shoulders, like a dog shaking off stress. Then she snaps at us, "Be back here in an hour." When we return, she goes to work on Calvin. "Your problem is that you want unconditional approval and admiration from women," she says bluntly. "When you're with someone you pay for, or a young, helpless dependent, you get that. But in a healthy relationship of two people with equal internal power, sometimes your partner doesn't agree with you or support your behavior, and that's where the real relating begins." "So I'm supposed to date someone who doesn't like me?" Calvin asks, genuinely confused. "No. You're supposed to grow up emotionally so that when someone you love doesn't constantly worship you or do what you want, it doesn't cause your entire sense of self to crumble." As Calvin takes this in, his eyes ring red, and he reaches for the Kleenex. By the time Lorraine turns her attention to me, the sun has already set. I promise myself that I will listen to her with an open mind, that I'll be less stubborn than Adam about whatever truth she's about to confront me with. Just like Adam has to separate from his wife to take care of himself, there are some things you need to cut off as well, she tells me. Besides sex and relationships? Absolutely. Though, of course, that depends on what you've decided you want since we last spoke. I talked to Hasi Wallam like you told me, and I just want to overcome my past so I can have a loving relationship and live my authentic life. More specifically, I want to do these things with Ingrid, but this doesn't seem like the best time to bring it up. How many women, she asks, who you've been sexual with, are you still in contact with? A lot, but I haven't been seeing them. Then let me ask you. Here it comes. The verbal Aikido that will use my words to topple my beliefs. Is it possible to live your authentic life if you have inauthentic people around you? She's backed me into a corner, just as she did to Adam and Calvin. Or more accurately, we've already backed ourselves into these corners, and she's just helping us see the walls. Probably not, I tell her, then correct myself. No, definitely not. That's right, she says. To empty out completely, you need to let go of all the negative messages you received about yourself as a child. And you need to separate from the lifestyle that you created as a reaction to them. So if you want to take back your life, you're going to be best served by ending contact with every female you've ever sexualized. Oh, God, I begin, my voice cracking. The pathological accommodator in me is terrified of rejecting so many people. The adolescent is reminded of being grounded. The player is afraid to die. No wonder I was able to keep my pledge to Lorraine relatively easily these last few weeks. They were just the first baby steps into anhedonia. At least I now know the answer to my building blocks question from earlier. The only way to fix a tower with a faulty base is to knock it down and rebuild it over a stronger foundation. So what would be the most compassionate way to do that? I ask. Why don't you think about all the different ways women get in touch with you and all the ways you seek them out and seal those doors shut permanently? A lump forms in my throat. On the blackboard, Lorraine writes stage two of her detox plan. All I have to do are four things. 1, change my phone number. 2, change my email address. 3, block all social networks on my computer. 4, don't give my new information to anyone with tits. And that's when I reach for the Kleenex. Chapter 6. There are the women I've slept with, the women I've fooled around with but haven't slept with, the women who don't want to sleep with me but hopefully one day will change their minds, the women who want to sleep with me but I don't want to sleep with them, though maybe on a lonely night I'd reconsider, the women who want to sleep with me and I want to sleep with them, but there's a complicating factor like distance or a boyfriend, the women I want to sleep with but I slept with their friend, and now it's a little awkward. And all the women I haven't met yet, but would want to sleep with if I met them. All told, it's a lot of women. Nearly a lifetime of work. Thousands of dollars squandered at bars and restaurants. Thousands of hours spent calling and messaging and emailing. Thousands of times saying things like, "Does Friday work for you?" And, "My ex and I ended things on good terms." And, "I have to show you this video on my computer." And, "I didn't think this was going to happen either." Whenever I haven't been working, whenever I haven't been studying, whenever I haven't been watching movies or reading books or playing video games, this has been what my waking life and some of my sleeping life has been about. And so I sit, frozen in the hotel room in front of my computer, a hoarder reluctant to part with the detritus of his past. Going sexually sober for a limited amount of time was a reasonable challenge, but making a permanent break with every single one of my options is terrifying when I'm not in a relationship. Yet if I want this one last shot at happiness with Ingrid when I see her again, assuming she hasn't completely moved on, then I must prepare for the trip before leaving, not after. "Let me help you," Adam offers. I stand up and he takes my seat, downloads a program that restricts access to specific websites, then shields the keyboard from my eyes as he types in a password. "I'm blocking all pornography, social networking, and dating sites from your computer," he informs me. "I used this program with my kids. If there's anything you want to post on these sites for your friends, you can send it to me and I'll post it for you, if it's appropriate." In just minutes, my pipeline to variety has been sealed shut. "Now for the email," Adam says cheerfully, clearly at home taking care of someone else's needs. "Can we do it in stages?" I ask. I sit down on the bed. I'm getting dizzy, lightheaded, nauseous. "You gotta rip off the Band-Aid. So are you gonna let me file divorce papers for you and your wife then?" He's not amused. Adam sets up a new email address for me. I make a list of less than 20 people, family, close friends, colleagues, to give it to. Then he changes the password on the old email account to lock me out, and we write an autoresponder letting everyone else from my past know I can no longer be reached there. "Man, this is weird," I tell Adam. "Feel my hands. I'm shaking. I'm like an alcoholic going through the DTs." "Fortunately for you, there's nothing I can do with your phone right now. But not only do you need to get a new number, you also need to get a flip phone that doesn't have internet access." "I'll do that when I'm home," I respond, grateful for the small reprieve. "Think of yourself as Tarzan," he suggests, repeating advice that Lorraine once gave him. "You can't hold on to the vine behind you and the vine in front of you forever. At some point, you have to let go of the past to move forward." Suddenly, my world has become much smaller. And after the initial fear and panic of letting go subside, I realize it's also become much easier to manage. Chapter 7. When we return to the workshop the next day, Lorraine looks more dispirited than I've ever seen her. "Most of the therapists here are as bad as the patients," she vents before the session begins. "Something must have happened with Joan this morning, and it likely has to do with us. They think their degrees and certifications give them permission to be one-up and constantly the adapted adolescent. Last week, Joan shamed one of the men's groups and told them that waitress was a sexist word. I talked to her about it, and I think reporting me was her way of retaliating. There's a weariness in her voice that I haven't noticed before. There's so many rules and politics here," she concludes, "that I can't do what I need to help people." We thank her for her dedication and courage. What we don't say is that, like Adam, it seems she's stuck in a relationship that doesn't meet her needs. And she's therapist enmeshing us. For the next 3 days, Lorraine perseveres, and soon her powers return, until the moment comes that I've been both dreading and hoping for. She puts each of us into a light trance to go through a more intense version of chair work that she calls an emotional root canal. I yell at my mother, my father, and the bully who fondled me. And like last time, the thick black curtain in front of my mind parts to reveal the truth. And I see that I've been making sex the most important criterion in my relationships at the expense of my own happiness. There wasn't one point in this last year where I searched for a deeper kind of emotional connection or a greater kind of love. It was all about exploring a single aspect of relationships, sexuality. And even in that one aspect, I failed. At the puja and in the sex-positive community, I found countless women who were sexually liberated and open and required only one thing, that they be empowered and in control of the context, because that's how they felt safe enough to truly let go. And I was uncomfortable with that. Did I ever really see who Kamala Devi was, or did I just see my mother? Could San Francisco have worked if I wasn't so hell-bent on making it go exactly my way and resenting anyone who threatened that? Why was the relationship with Sage so great until she wanted her freedom and I lost my absolute control? And why, in so many of these experiences, could I not let go when I felt vulnerable around women, not to mention other men? The answer? I was never actually pursuing sexual freedom. I was pursuing control, power, and self-worth. I was either acting like my mom or making someone into my mom, but rarely was I actually myself. Because as I witnessed on Ecstasy, the feeling that I'm not acceptable as I am is so fucking overwhelming that I'm terrified to let go and just be myself with anyone. I've been the benevolent dictator of not just everyone else, but also my own fucking self. As this last insight hits home, I dissolve into a puddle of tears. Lorraine waits as I wipe my nose on the back of my hand. Then she speaks slowly and gently. "All the things you've been trying to get from these relationships, freedom, understanding, fairness, acceptance, are exactly the things that you never got from your mom. So every time you load all that unfinished business onto your partner, you're setting yourself up for another disappointment. Because as an adult, the only person who can give you those things is you. Do you understand that?" "Yes," I tell her. "I do. And I really do." She invites Adam to the chair next and proceeds to blow his mind. When he opens his eyes afterward, they're brilliantly beaming, and in a happy-go-lucky voice that differs from his usual beaten-down and measured tone, he exclaims, "I want some ice cream." His inner child, whose needs he's been repressing his whole life, has finally spoken up. It's probably been decades since he's allowed himself to enjoy even a morsel of sugar. This process is the closest thing I've seen to a miracle. An hour later, we're eating ice cream. "I've missed me," Adam says between shovelfuls of an Oreo-topped sundae, the that Lorraine went out and bought for him. Calvin sits mutely nearby, shell-shock from his own epiphany, which is that if you become the hero in an enmeshed family as an adult, accepting that role will occupy the space your heart has available for a relationship. So Lorraine insisted that he draw strong boundaries with his parents, even though he feels that they need him right now. Meanwhile, I work up the nerve to tell Lorraine about the wedding invitation from Ingrid's brother. When she doesn't seem to disapprove of my attending, I ask her the question that's been worrying me since Machu Picchu. How will I know I'm truly ready this time, and not one of those love avoiders who wants to be in a relationship when he isn't in one, then wants to be free when he's in a relationship? Lorraine responds cryptically. Do you know the story of the prodigal son? Adam nods his head vigorously, melted ice cream dribbling down his face. He knows his Bible well. Lorraine tells us her version of the story anyway. A father has two sons, she begins. The older one is a good son. He does everything he should, pleases the father, and stays on the farm to take care of it. The younger one leaves the family, spends all his father's money on partying and prostitutes, doesn't stay in touch, almost starves to death, and then finally returns and begs to be allowed to take care of the farm with his brother again. When the father throws a huge celebration to welcome his youngest son back home, the older brother asks, "What about me?" And do you know what the father replies? He says that a Christian should always be merciful and allow someone to repent. Adam tries. Perhaps, Lorraine responds. But I like to believe he also said something else. You worked on the farm because you felt like you should. Your brother came back to work on the farm out of choice. And that is the more meaningful of the two. She pauses and lets it sink in for all of us. Love, she concludes, is something about a person, some connection with them, that makes you willing to change. As Adam scrapes the sides of his bowl clean, I realize why monogamy never worked for me before. It's always been something that I felt my partner expected or made me do. If I treat it as a choice this time, as opposed to a demand, then maybe I can be the prodigal boyfriend. Lorraine sees the hope illuminating my face and quickly warns, "You, my friend, are on a deadline to love right now. If you want any hope of being in a relationship with Ingrid again, you're going to have to attack your trauma with all the commitment you have and every tool there is before that wedding. Only after you've learned how to be alone without loneliness will you be ready for a relationship." "What other tools are there?" I ask. She lists them for me, a litany of therapies designed to work on different senses. They're unfamiliar, word combinations I've never heard before, but I write them down like a prescription. "My biggest worry," I tell her, "is that after I did the chair work with you last time, I felt just like this. I had so much clarity and hope. But when I returned to my normal environment, I totally reverted to my old thoughts and behaviors." She holds her fingers to her lips and considers the dilemma for a moment. "As you peel away the layers of the false self," she responds, "you're going to start feeling the pain inside that it's protecting you from. So you're going to get very raw and uncomfortable before you get better. I think you may have gotten stuck in those feelings last time, and that's why you left Ingrid. But if you can process all that old pain in an adult, healthy way this time, you won't need your old walls and defenses anymore." It's a lot to take in, and I struggle to understand it all. Then I decide I don't need to understand it, I just need to do it. There's only one problem. What if afterward, I ask, I go to the wedding, and I'm truly ready in my heart and soul to commit, and Ingrid's with someone else, or doesn't want to be with me again? Lorraine's eyes smile into mine, makeup cracked over the lids like dry earth, as she answers without hesitation. If she doesn't want you back, and she's the catalyst for this change, then she's the best thing that ever happened to you. Chapter 8. Curtis Roundson waves a thin metal rod back and forth in front of my eyes as I recall memories of my mother. He then places headphones over my ears and plays tones that jump from the right earpiece to the left one as I keep remembering and feeling pain, remembering and feeling pain, until I'm just remembering. Lindsey Joy Green ducks as I send my fist flying into the air with all my strength, releasing anger that feels like it's been trapped in my wrist for decades. I do it over and over again with each hand until I just don't need to anymore. Olga Stevko spends 8 hours hypnotizing me. I walk around her office, entering the minds of my parents in search of the things they didn't get from their parents. Then I imagine flowing these qualities to each person in my family back 7 generations and then forward to me in the moment I was conceived, until I feel like I actually grew up with them. Greg Kaysen gives me homework. Lots of it. Thought records, goal sheets, written exposures, gratitude diaries, behavioral experiments. Each one chipping away at my fears and pathological accommodation until I can see them as the delusions they are. Barbara McNally tells me to close my eyes, picture myself and my mother in a room with a white light coming from me and an X over her, and then imagine yelling, "Give me the fucking keys," as I punch her in the face repeatedly. I am at war. It is a strange fucking war, but I am winning. On a scale of 1 to 10, how strong is the emotion attached to the memories we've been working on? Curtis Roundson asks one day. The procedure I've been going through with him is called EMDR, or Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing, which looks at the way trauma is stored in the brain and attempts to properly process it. If it used to be a 10, now it's an 8, I tell him. Lindsey Joy Green is trained in a therapy called SE, or Somatic Experiencing, and she's been locating trauma trapped not in my brain, but in my body, and releasing the stored energy. One day she asks, "On a scale of 1 to 10, how much anger do you feel when you recall the memories we've been discussing?" "If it used to be an 8, now it's a 7, I tell her. Olga Stevko practices her own variant of NLP, or neuro-linguistic programming. Where the experientials with Lorraine were about debugging my operating system, her process is about rewriting the original code. For example, she tells me that inside my mother's words, "Never grow up to make anyone as miserable as your father makes me," was a hidden command. Never grow up. As she helps me grow up, it brings my trauma down to a 6. Greg Kaysen specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy, which takes it to a 5. And I don't know what to call Barbara McNally's method and her bottomless quiver of techniques, but they work, they're original, and they bring the emotion associated with those memories to a 4. And I do so much more. I beat pillows with baseball bats, I tap on energy meridians, I make shadow maps of my dark side, I try psychodrama. Not all of it works, but none of it hurts. One morning, I notice that half the boxer shorts in my dresser are gifts my mother has given me for various birthdays and holidays. Most are novelty-themed with semi-sexual jokes on them, like male and female gender signs with the words "change often" next to them. Though I feel a pang of guilt as I scoop them up and toss them in the trash, I recall Barbara McNally telling me that this kind of guilt is a good thing. It means that I'm finally doing the work of separation. While I'm at it, I throw away all the keys to old cars and apartments that I've saved in some unconscious attempt to prove to my mother that I won't ever lose them. As Lorraine predicted, I feel fragile and vulnerable during this shock and awe campaign, as if my skin has been removed and all my nerves exposed. the slightest stress, be it a small criticism from a colleague, an obstacle standing in the way of a project I need to complete, someone asking me to repeat myself, a restaurant being out of my favorite dish, fills me with disproportionate anxiety and rage. Even if a person says something nice to me, I misinterpret it as rude and disrespectful. And every night, I toss and turn, obsessing over the events of the last few years, unable to fall asleep. This isn't making me happy, I complain to Rick one dark morning. The purpose is not to feel good or to have fun, Rick reminds me. It's to force feelings to surface so they can be examined and to find the deeper causes for your behavior. In that respect, it's working amazingly well. How you feel during the process is the least important part. So you can feel good to the extent that you're doing the work to learn about yourself and you're willing to look at the feelings that come up. That's the part to hold on to. So I push through the pain and fight harder. It eats into my bank account, but in the long run, I'm saving thousands of times this amount of money on bad dates, dramatic relationships, short-lived marriages, poor decisions, and the false friends I'm trauma-bonded to. I am motivated by the mistakes of the past, the hope of a better future, the desperate dream of Ingrid, and the feeling deep down that finally, after all this searching, I'm doing the right thing. Not just for Ingrid or for my relationships, but for me. Instead of trying to find other people to complete me, I am finally completing myself. Chapter 9. Today, I'm doing something even more excruciating than therapy. I'm sitting at an STI clinic, preparing to get tested for literally everything. As I wait to see the nurse, I think of all the women I was with while dating Sage. The one whose period started shortly after I went down on her. The one who dropped her ass on me before I had a chance to put a condom on. The one who the rubber slipped off inside. And then all the women who went down on me while I basically had an open sore in my dick. And what if that sore wasn't from friction? Then there's Sage. She said she was clean, but who knows when she was last tested? I don't think I could show my face to Ingrid again if I caught something during this time. What if this whole quest for freedom has instead sentenced me to death? What if instead of having my cake and eating it, I end up having no cake and nothing to eat? I call for my test results several stress-filled days later. As the nurse looks for them, my heart curls into a tight ball. My forehead knits. Even my dick is tense, as if a guillotine blade is about to drop onto it. Finally, she returns to the phone. You're negative for HIV, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and... I silently rejoice, but then she hesitates, as if about to say something awkward. The rejoicing ends. This is odd, she continues. Fuck. I knew something was wrong. What if it's incurable? You tested negative for herpes. Negative? Just about everyone has herpes, she says, as if it's the equivalent of pimples. And in that moment, I'm grateful to my parents for their immune system. Thank you, I tell her. I think I love you. I love you too, honey, she says and hangs up, my blood-drawing angel. One advantage to monogamy, no more terrifying STI tests. Relieved and reprieved, I continue the war in my past. There are, of course, experiences that I can't access, preconscious, early childhood, and forgotten imprints. And surely a great deal of the damage is done in those crucial first few years. But when I ask about it at a weekend workshop just outside Los Angeles, run by a trauma healing center called The Refuge, I'm reassured that what I remember is a window into what I've forgotten, that the patterns likely stayed the same, that a narcissistic parent was always a narcissistic parent. On my way home from the refuge workshop, I stopped by my friend Melanie's birthday party at a West Hollywood bar. Since starting this voyage into anhedonia, it's one of the only social events I've attended. I'm wearing jeans and a hoodie, feeling very antisocial, and planning to just give Melanie her present and then duck out. But as soon as I walk in the door, I spot trouble. Elizabeth, the tech entrepreneur Melanie introduced me 2 years ago, the one who said she'd have sex with me only if I agreed to marry her. "I've been trying to reach you," she says in greeting. She's wearing a low-cut green dress and black strappy stilettos. I change my number, I tell her, polite but curt. She continues unfazed. "I've had a little to drink, so I can tell you this. You're part of the reason I broke things off with my boyfriend. I made a list of the qualities I look for in men. Then I made a list of the potential men in my life. Then I compiled all the data on a graph, and you rated highest in every category except one." I get the sneaking suspicion that she prepared this ambush in advance. "Let me guess," I respond dispassionately. "Stability." "That's exactly it," she replies, holding eye contact. The first thing I thought when I broke up with him was, now I can fuck Neil Strauss. I've never been hit on this aggressively. Either she's relaxed her marriage criteria, or she's a subscriber to the twins' dangle the sexual carrot theory of seduction. The old me would be intrigued enough to find out which. The new me is intrigued for a fleeting moment, but fortunately, he makes better decisions. "Unfortunately," I tell her, "you're too late, because I'm off the market." I start to walk away, but she asks after me, "You're still not in love with that blonde girl, are you?" She sneers the word girl as if she's saying peasant. I stop and tell her, "I am, actually." The words are much easier to articulate than I would have imagined. "I don't think she's at your level." Elizabeth is undeterred. "I saw a photo of you two online. Her nail polish was chipped." Now that I'm not seeing Elizabeth, or any woman, as a means to a sexual end, I'm astonished that I was ever interested in her. If I were dying of altitude sickness in Machu Picchu, she's the type who'd leave if she saw a rich guy landing in a helicopter nearby. "That's the great thing about Ingrid," I inform her. "She doesn't define herself by her looks. One day she sent me photos she'd put into some apps, and they showed what she'd look like fat and old." This is when Elizabeth says the one thing that until recently would have affected my last ounce of resolve like kryptonite. "Since our talk, I've decided that I want a more open relationship. I don't want to keep a man from exploring his sexuality or having experiences with other women. I think it's natural for a man to want variety." "Well, I hope you find someone," I respond. I'm grateful to find myself unmoved by her words. Either I'm healing, or I'm just really irritable from all this wound scraping. "Good seeing you again," I tell her. Instead of saying goodbye, she kneels at my feet, a still life of submission. She then slowly ties the loose laces on one of my shoes, gazing up at me the whole time, edging into the space between my legs, and then freezing there for a moment to give my mind's eye the exact picture it needs to imagine what could still happen tonight. This is the moment the Red Demons and I always talked about, wondering if we could resist the lure of easy sex with a beautiful woman. Elizabeth slowly rises to her feet, letting her freshly polished nails linger on my arm as a testament to her superiority over Ingrid. Sensing victory, she purrs. "My mother always used to say, if you thought it, then you already cheated." "Well, I'll just have to live with that," I tell her, bidding her a final goodbye and walking off to greet Melanie. Fortunately, it turns out I can resist. As I head home a little later, feeling like the target instead of the player, I'm unexpectedly elated. This is the first time I've turned down sex from a potential partner I'm physically attracted to, and more so, a non-monogamous relationship, and I have no regrets. If Ingrid knelt on the ground to tie my shoelaces, it would be because she wanted to tie my shoelaces, not because she wanted to seduce me into thinking she'd be the perfect wife. I think back to the photos Ingrid texted me, the ones with her face altered to look unflattering. The message that accompanied them read, "Let's grow old and fat together." I wondered in Peru what love was. That is love. It's when two or more hearts build a safe emotional, mental, and spiritual home that will stand strong no matter how much anyone changes on the inside or the outside. It demands only one thing and expects only one thing, that each person be his or her own true self. Everything else we attach to love is just a personal strategy, be it effective or ineffective, for trying to manage our anxiety about coming so close to something so powerful and uncontrollable. I return to the treehouse, which is free of chaos and clutter, and to bed, which is free of cigarette smoke, condom wrappers, and wet spots from spilled drinks and other fluids. And I realize that I made a mistake by equating variety with freedom. I'm off all social and dating apps and websites. That's freedom. Less than 20 people have my email address. That's freedom. My phone barely makes a sound. That's freedom. I have my life back. That's freedom. I didn't catch anything communicable. That's a fucking relief. I am truly alone, bereft of options for the first time since puberty. And oddly, I don't mind at all. It turns out that leaving all my options open has kept me too busy juggling them to really live. Studies on choice even affirm that having too many options leads to less happiness and satisfaction. I think back to my childhood, to the irrational rules, and the bedside conversations, and the constant criticism, and I feel nothing. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's now a 1. Chapter 10. The following week, something snaps. It begins when I'm talking to my mother on the phone. We haven't spoken for a while because I've been avoiding anything that could interfere with the work I'm doing. But when she mentions that this year will be her 49th wedding anniversary, I walk right into her trap and ask, "Do you want anything special for your 50th anniversary?" "No," she replies with scorn. "Why would I want anything honoring that?" She pauses, then decides, "Well, there is something you can do for my 50th anniversary. Shoot your father." She laughs, as if it's funny, then adds as an afterthought, "Actually, if you wanted to shoot him for my 49th anniversary, that would be fine too." Her comment doesn't bother me or make me feel like I'm being asphyxiated, nor does it cause me to feel sorry for her or for Dad. It just rolls off me like a child's attempt to recruit a stranger in a personal vendetta. That's when I see our relationship as if it were a movie, with distance, detachment, and clarity. It's a black comedy about a mother who feels victimized by her husband, yet too broken to do anything about it. So nearly everything in her life, including her own son, becomes a weapon to use or an ally to recruit in her private, solitary war against this oblivious man. As I end the conversation with her, not only do I let go of any remaining expectations that she'll be nurturing or mothering, but I let go, without guilt, of any obligations I owe her as my mother. And it is this moment of release, of changing her role in my life from mother to adapted adolescent, that ultimately frees me. With that original trauma bond broken, in the days that follow, I'm possessed by a feeling I've never experienced before. In fact, it's hard to actually call it a feeling. It is the absence of feeling. Sometimes I'll sit on the couch and just listen to the sounds outside, look around the room and through the window, and think about nothing. Or I'll move through the house in slow motion, disconnected from my usual sense of urgency, going about everyday behaviors like brushing my teeth, as if they're the only things I have to do in my lifetime. It's like zoning out, except there's nowhere to zone out to. It's as if there's nothing in my head. I don't even know if I feel good or bad. I'm beyond good and bad. I just am. When I try to sleep at night, my breathing seems light, like it's not filling my lungs with the oxygen they need. My heartbeat seems faint, like it might stop at any time. My mind seems slow, as if my neurons are degenerating and I'm drifting into a painless death. I've finally emptied out. I've forced gummed myself. I am truly in anhedonia, if not in a void beyond it. There's just one problem. Lorraine never told me what I was supposed to fill up with afterward, so I email her to find out. She doesn't respond. A few days later, I try her again. And still, there's nothing. I'm reminded of Ingrid's deadly silence, yet it doesn't feel like abandonment. I'm too empty to feel even pain. I am, as Lorraine predicted, deeply alone, but without a trace of loneliness. As the week passes without a response from Lorraine, I start to wonder, quite apathetically, if she's turned me into a zombie, doomed to spend the rest of my life brain dead. I call her and leave a message, asking in a slow, confused voice what the next step is and how to fill up. But still, she doesn't respond, and she never will.
Stage 2. Filling up. A time comes when you're all alone, when you've come to the end of everything that can happen to you. It's the end of the world. Even grief, your own grief, doesn't answer you anymore, and you have to retrace your steps to go back among people. Louis Ferdinand Céline, Journey to the End of the Night.
Chapter 11. I look into his face. The first thing I notice is the smile, all gums and crooked teeth. Then there are the black glasses, too large and harsh for his face. And most tragically, there's the hair, cut amateurishly short with crooked bangs and random wavy lumps. Yet, despite all this, there's something about him that's delightful to look at. It's not just his innocence and naivete, but his eagerness to please, to learn, to become. And that's when it happens. Something finally moves in me. It appears to be a feeling. It's hard to tell whether it's love or sadness. Quite possibly it's both. But it's pure. A love and a sadness. For him, for myself. I'm looking at an elementary school class photo of myself, age 8, which I dug out of an envelope buried in my file cabinet. I can't remember the last time I looked at my childhood photos. I am filling up, and I'm doing it on my own. Both Adam and Calvin called earlier in the day, panicked because they were experiencing their own crises and hadn't heard back from Lorraine either. Fortunately, Calvin gave me the clue I needed. He read the last email Lorraine had sent him, which concluded with the advice, "You have your own internal therapist that is far wiser than any external therapist you could consult. You just need to find that voice and listen to it." It seemed like her way of saying goodbye, though we had no idea why. Maybe we were taking up too much of her time. Maybe this was tough love. Or maybe Joan had gotten her suspended for working with patients who'd left rehab AMA. Whatever her reasons may have been, those final words were worth taking seriously. So I sat in my zone-out couch and reflected on what had brought me up to this point. The first steps were doing a timeline and genogram, which allowed me to identify my wounds. The second steps were the intense therapeutic processes, which emptied and cleaned out the wounds. So the third step must be to fill in the holes left by them. But fill them with what? Something Lorraine said the first time we did chair work drifted into my mind. She asked me to protect and look after my inner child. So I rose from the sofa and rummaged around the file cabinet until I found my old photos. When I truly saw for the first time the wounded child I'd been working so hard to heal, that's when the feelings began to come back. I used to think that the term inner child was a ridiculous metaphor invented to remind responsibility-burdened adults to lighten up occasionally and just have fun. But it turns out that the inner child is very real. It is our past. And the only way to escape the past is to embrace it. So before going to bed that night, I put the photo in a frame and place it next to my bed. And I vow that from this day forward, that child will be protected. He will be loved. He will be accepted. He will be trusted. And all this will be given unconditionally. He will not be taught to hate and fear. He will not be criticized for failing to live up to unrealistic expectations. He will not be used as a Kleenex or aspirin for someone else's feelings of loneliness, fear, depression, or anxiety. The next morning, I start filling him and me with the things I needed but never had as a child. When I have a negative thought about myself, I gently replace it with a positive truth. When I make a mistake, I forgive myself. When I'm too thin-skinned or thick-skinned, I gently guide myself back into moderate reality. And when I regress, I silently soothe myself as if teaching a child not to be afraid of the dark. Just as I told Anne to be a good mother to herself, I'm reparenting myself. It's somewhat pathetic that at this age, I need to properly learn how to be an adult. But if the problems I have in relationships are the result of developmental immaturities, then by nurturing these stunted parts of myself into a growth spurt, perhaps I'll finally attain the happiness and stability that have eluded me through them all. So with this small crack of light shining into my numbness, I start creating a new life. Each day, I try to take care of the six core needs Lorraine told me about: physical, by surfing and eating healthily; emotional, by allowing myself to experience and express feelings without being either hyper-controlling or out of control with them; social, by spending time with Adam, Calvin, Rick, and other growth-minded friends; intellectual, by reading literature, listening to lectures, starting a film discussion group, and most importantly, simply listening more; and most alien of all for me, spiritual, through transcendental meditation, which a friend of Rick's teaches me. But the biggest challenge is the sixth core need, sexual, especially since I'm chaste and porn free right now. So while continuing with the rest of my self-care regimen, I decide to skip this one. I've fulfilled enough sexual needs to last several lifetimes. And maybe it's for the best that Lorraine never responded, because now it's truly my life that I'm rebuilding. I've cleansed the childhood wounds, and I'm filling the holes inside. All my life, I've been trying to fill the wrong holes. Chapter 12. 6 days before Hans's wedding, and just a couple of weeks into my new self-care regimen, I wake up and the last remnants of torpor